Welcome to the Lentil Intervention Podcast, talking all things movement, whole food nutrition and environmental wellness with your hosts, Ben and Emma.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 3 and part 2 of our series on wetlands. My name is Ben Adelberg, coming to you from Auckland and from Boona, Emma Strutt. Hello, Emma.
Hello, Benjamin. How's your training going?
Oh, gosh. Here we go. We're under a week to go now. Yeah, I guess as ready as I can be. So I think
feeling
our listeners...
Feeling pumped or feeling exhausted?
Feeling nervous. Yeah. I'm getting rested, but I'm feeling nervous now. There's a little bit of expectation now, I guess, to deliver. But yeah, job is done in terms of training. And now it's all about getting the run down. And for our listeners, you also have one job left to do. The fundraiser for the Native Forest Restoration Trust. We've got a link on our Facebook page. We've got a link in the bio, our Instagram bio, and of course on our website. Please, this is your last week to donate. Really appreciate everyone that has already done so. So World Wetlands Day was
2nd of Feb.
That's right. And the last episode, we spoke to Melanie Dixon, Deputy Chairperson of the National Wetland Trust of New Zealand. And today we're actually going to get a little more specific.
That's right. We're jumping ship over the ditch to Australia. And
Dr. Ian Tibbetts is an Associate Professor at the School of Biological Sciences at the University of Queensland. He serves as a director for the Moreton Bay Foundation and was lead editor for the Foundation's first publication in 2019. So he's quite the expert when it comes to all things Moreton Bay. Ian has also been appointed chair of the scientific expert panel advising the Minister of Fisheries on the sustainable fisheries strategy. Ian, thank you so much for joining us today.
No, thanks, Emma. Great to be with you.
Welcome, Ian. And first things first, very first question, especially for our listeners not from Southeast Queensland. Can you explain to us where Moreton Bay is and what area it encompasses?
Yeah, so Moreton Bay is a large embayment on the east coast of Australia. So if you think of a map of Australia, look at the map of Australia on the east coast, the right-hand side, move about halfway down, and that's where you'll find Moreton Bay. And it's a big system. I mean, I express that in terms of like driving. If you want to drive from the top end of it down to the south end of it, you know, 100 kilometers an hour, you're set for a 2-hour ride. So, you know, it's a big thing. And yeah. I mean, the interesting thing that fascinates me is that, you know, the curvature of the earth kind of comes into it. When you're even in the Central Bay, looking towards the Glasshouse Mountains towards the north, you can just see them poking above the horizon. It's really cool, you know. So you get this impression of this, you know, this large body of water. And it's a fantastic place, terrific diversity and just a beautiful part of the world.
Yeah. Now, I believe that's a very popular area for a number of, say, activities and whether it's recreational or commercial even as well.
Oh, yeah, heaps. I mean, we're sitting in what is effectively a conurbation that stretches from the Gold Coast, which many people be familiar with, up to the Sunshine Coast, with Brisbane City sort of in the center of that sort of span. So if you think about the catchment of about 3 million people there who are reasonably well off and still pretty mobile given the current situation, that it is heavily used for recreation. There are commercial fisheries that are used in the bay. The Brisbane is a major port, so there's a major port facility there. It's got some very large marinas for access by yachties and various boaties. And it offers, even with the number of people there and using it, opportunities for solitude and reflection that, you know, do well to people's souls. So, you know, it provides a huge range of services. And also, I think fundamentally importantly, you know, it's being guarded and looked after by Indigenous owners for millennia, and that is a very strong part of the nature, the character of Moreton Bay. It's reflected everywhere.
Yeah. Now, Moreton Bay, it's arguably one of Australia's most important coastal areas for a range of reasons, including some of the ones you've just listed. Anyone familiar with its beauty should really be concerned about, you know, preserving it and protecting it. So please tell us a little bit about the Moreton Bay Foundation and how you're giving the bay the voice it needs.
Yeah, well, I'll give you like a little potted history, if I may. So yes. I helped run a conference back in 1996, if anybody is young enough to remember that, old enough to remember that. It was a long time ago, and I ran a conference about Moreton Bay. So it was called Moreton Bay and Catchment. We published a book from that out of the University of Queensland. And then it was getting towards the bidecadal anniversary of it. So I was getting, it was starting to get, it was 2014, 2015, I was getting a bit twitchy about, well, we haven't really had another meeting. Much as I don't like running large conferences, I thought we'd probably be doing a good idea. So I floated it past some of my academic colleagues in different institutions and said, look, why don't we get together again at the 20-year anniversary? So we had this meeting, which produced that book that you mentioned earlier that the foundation published. And at that meeting, at the end of that meeting, one of the key sort of, I suppose, visionaries for the Bay, or the family of visionaries for the Bay, the Goodman family, who have a Goodman Foundation. One of the members stood up at the end of the meeting, John Goodman, and he said, look, this can't happen again. You can't have another 20 years without getting together and talking about the serious issues that face Moreton Bay. What are we going to do about it? And I'm willing to put some money in to support research activity in Moreton Bay to get people together and meeting to find solutions for the challenges that face the Bay. And John Goodman, Meta Goodman, and other members of the Goodman Foundation backed this up. And that was the pathway to setting up the foundation. And importantly, it strove to be not just a single institution getting involved in this, but multiple institutions in the region. So Griffith University, the University of the Sunshine Coast, USC, I should call them, USC, Queensland University of Technology, the University of Queensland, and the Quandam Mokuyulaburaburi Aboriginal Corporation, who are the native nature title rights over much of the region, partnered to get this off the ground. So we have institutional members who are backing it. We have members of the public who back it, organisations that back it outside of that. And we are intent on focusing science to solve the issues of Moreton Bay and to protect it for future generations in a time of quite significant change and challenge. But yeah, the mission is to focus science and clear thinking and collective informed decision making to help us move forward to a better place.
Now, as part of this process, you mentioned earlier the acknowledgement and collaboration with the traditional owners, the Quandamooka people. Is that
yes?
How important is that? How crucial is that?
Well, I mean, vital. I mean, it's been shown, I think, quite convincingly in several settings about the wise management of the land that traditional owners have conducted. And I'm thinking in terrestrial context here, with the relationship with the Aboriginal people and like fire management, for example, water resource management in catchment areas that, you know, and if you read the historical texts about the huge productivity of these systems and diversity of these systems that they've established over thousands of years, it's really a call to, I suppose, push back against the way that we, I'm talking me, like white, you know, white guys or whatever, or newcomers, I suppose, have come in and try to enforce the millennia of destruction that we've exerted on other areas of the planet, and to use those things to kind of tame nature rather than work with it and find its rhythms. And that's what we need to get back. So, yeah, we need to listen very carefully to traditional owners who've got a long history of you know, both exploiting the resources and securing the resources of future generations. And I see their role as pivotal, as leads in this activity. So, you know, together we're just trying to foster an environment where we can, you know, generate resources, funds, information to focus on particular issues. But the lead here, you know, I think we've shown our inability to wisely look after these resources. We really need to listen very, very carefully and have traditional owners front and center leading these activities. And I think that's going to be That's the way of the future, I think.
What are some of the projects that the foundation's working on at the moment?
So at the moment, the foundation was sort of formally established in August 2019. Since then, we've got what's called DGR status, which means we're an organization who can receive, you know, gifts, philanthropic gifts from folks to support our work. And when COVID hit, okay, so 2019, we were getting our act together, and then COVID kind of crashed the scene. And there was a couple of ways of going, all right? We'd say, okay, well, COVID's hit, we've got to shut down and, like, wait until COVID goes. And then we thought, you know, the board was discussing this and consulting with others. This is a time to maybe try and keep some stuff going. We knew that various sectors had taken a big hit in terms of their ability to fund research because of the suddenly turning off the tap. I mean, Australian education system's kind of, driven to a large extent, or supported to quite a considerable extent, by international students. And when that sort of spigot was turned off, then really there was folks looking at each other going, how are we going to keep going? What are we going to do? So we thought that an opportunity, but both in terms of travel restrictions, folks who would otherwise have traveled over internationally to pursue their research would now be here. There may be a paucity of funding to support research projects. It was really a time where we could inject some optimism and maintain activity. And there were two key projects that we supported through a call for research projects, which we launched, I think it was in April 2020. And they're different, quite different objectives. One is focused on using drone technology to accurately census wading birds. And folks might go, what? That's, wading birds are the underpinning to the Ramsar agreement and convention, which Australia has signed up to, and Moreton Bay is a recognised Ramsar wetland. Okay, so this is a big international agreement to protect wading birds on their migratory pathways. Accurate knowledge of those populations is really important to know how they are going. All right, are we seeing reductions in the numbers? Are we, how we can respond to that? Are they seemingly healthy? So that was one of the projects that got off the ground, which we're delighted to support. So that provides evidentiary material for assessing the performance of the Bay in terms of its Ramsar obligations. The other one was really about communicating to people about the values of the Bay, all right? And that's sort of, the life of the Bay. So using a whole range of technologies, both underwater, aerial drones, underwater, video, seascapes and these sorts of things to communicate the sort of values of the Bay. So those are the two main projects. One was focused on like an outward facing sort of, public kind of engagement. And the other one, which is really vital, because you've got to have constituents to change, right? If you don't value an environment, you don't understand its values, you don't absorb those values, then you can't really get committed to engaging with supporting it. And the other one was very much about what's the evidentiary stuff we need. What are the major levers of science? And one of these major levers are these wading birds and the habitat quality and the assessing the numbers of them. So, yeah, those are the two areas. So rather than sit on our hands, we decided to get up and do something. And I think that's probably the right choice.
Now, there's a paper that we've recently come across, very recently published, 13th of January this year, titled Underestimating the Challenges of Avoiding a Ghastly Future. And it has it's a great title. It refers to major environmental change categories, such as Earth surfaces, there's only one, oceans, predatory fish, terrestrial biodiversity, etc., etc. It's 14 categories, and it looks at the percentage of how much is remaining intact or unaffected versus how much has been damaged, lost, affected. And the category that has the highest percentage of damage, being damaged, lost, or affected, is wetland area. And it's I guess it's a it's an in-between. We talk a lot about the effects of what we're doing on, I guess, the Earth's surfaces itself, the terrestrial surface. We talk a lot about the state of our oceans, but wetlands is a bit of an in-between. And it seems that we don't talk enough about it. And yes, it's the most affected area on our planet. So can you explain to us a little bit about the importance of these wetlands when it comes to biodiversity, water quality, the ecosystems, etc.? Why are they so important?
Yeah, well, I mean, the reason why you have this particular environment being the most seriously affected is this, you know, requirements of humans for water and also for transport. So if you think back, wait, let's take Stonehenge for an example. All right. You've got those huge rocks that they made Stonehenge of. That's actually near a river. Okay. So they could move those things, even prehistoric times, using water to float things. All right. And then you go to the early stages of the Industrial Revolution. You've got canals being dug so you can float things in water and move them around. And we still, you know, you see container ships coming in to major ports. That's always going to be a focus of human habitation occupation. It's driven both by amenity. It's nice to live by the sea, by the wetlands. But there's also very many practical reasons why those places are important. They're strategically important, militarily important, you know, and so on and so forth. So there's a natural tendency for expansion of populations near coastal areas, and they're going to intersect with coastal wetlands. Coastal wetlands, typically the ones we're kind of talking of, there's a broad range of wetland varieties. I'm focusing mainly on marine. And those things have not always been highly valued. If we think about the, you know, folks coming here in the early days, you've got these strange trees that are growing out of the marine muds on the shores, and they seem to host lots of bitey things that the people don't really like, no-see-ums or midges or whatever, what have you, mosquitoes carrying disease. There's wetland there, other wetland areas like salt marsh, where it's a bit hard to get around. It doesn't look of any particular value, and think I'll just fill that in, stick a building on it, right? So there's been this sort of undervaluing of these areas, colliding with the what humans perceive their priorities are in terms of their need for trade or their need to put a house in a nice place, so on and so forth. And really, it's only become over the past, I suppose, 50, 60 years, the value of wetlands to humans has become really important. There are physical values. Okay, so if you take mangroves, then they're a terrific resource both ways in terms of filtering water that would move through the terrestrial wetland, through the over the salt marsh and through the mangrove system into a bay, for example, like Moreton Bay. Then there are benefits the other way. So if you have a large storm surge, you have a, you know, cyclone come through, or hurricane for those of you who are watching from the US, then that provides a massive buffering effect to those coastal storms. So there are human well-being aspects to it, not just keeping the ocean clean, but also protecting our shoreline. So these wetland habitats are really important. When you go to things like fisheries, for example, fish live in them and blah. So, you know, the wetland habitats provide an incredible resource for juvenile fish. So there are some little critters that I doubt many folks listening may have heard of, hopefully a few, called miafauna. These are tiny little things. You've got to use a microscope to see. The very largest of them is just visible by the naked eye. And these things live in the surface of muddy sediments. They live in seagrasses and amid mangrove roots. And baby fish, that's the first thing they feed on when they settle out of the plankton. When they move out of the plankton environment, they settle in these shallow areas, moving in and out with the tide. They have to feed on those, all right? So you wouldn't know, walking across a muddy shore, you'd think, well, this is no, you know, what's the go here? This is, you know. It's critical, really, really important for these little fish. And I think folks should spend more time appreciating mud. I actually do mud walks, right? So, like, and they sell out. So I don't know whether it's a characteristic of folks that live in Brisbane or whether it's more universal. But nobody, you know, folks will take you for a walk through, you know, to look at a mangrove, or they'll go, oh, here's some seagrass. But, you know, nobody really appreciates the values of mud. and I really like mud. So, it's immensely valuable. I mentioned the wading birds earlier, and of course they're, you know, probing in. Some are feeding from the surface on these little critters. Others are probing deeper into it. Those organisms deep within the substrate. So, no, marvelous stuff. Mud, glorious mud. Nothing quite like it for cooling the blood.
No boardwalks here. We're going straight into it.
Boardwalk over mud. Imagine that. So anyway.
So you've spoken about, you know, basically the white men coming along and it's the same anywhere in the world. It's where a lot of populations have developed. You know, there's a lot of development, mm-hmm. a lot of coastal cities, a lot of coastal mm-hmm. urbanization. With that, stormwater, sewerage, pollutants mm-hmm. off the streets, et cetera, et cetera. So what is the impact on, well, I was going to say the mangroves, but the wetland areas in general when it comes to pollutants and debris? And, you know, we've mentioned ports of Brisbane. So it's a major mm-hmm. shipping channel. So there's a mm-hmm. lot of, unfortunately, a lot of waste that can come from that as well. How's that impacting the area?
Well, yeah, it's going to, right? So if you think of plastics, and plastics are pretty high on folks' radar at the moment, mangroves are actually pretty good at catching them. So if you think of plastic being driven to the edge, and you've got this complex sort of root community, either things like the river mangrove, Avicennia's got these little, like these, they're breathing roots that stick up through the mud, right? Call pneumatophores. And it's like a comb, right? So the tide comes in, lifts debris over the surface. And then when the tide recedes, it gets caught in there. Other mangroves do the same sort of thing as complex structures. So some mangroves are actually sort of helping us out a bit. All right. We're having negative impacts on them. But for example, at the University of Queensland, we do there's a thing called Clean Up Australia Day. And we participate, the folks at the marine sort of facing communities at UQ participate in that. We go and clean a stretch of the riverbank. We do it every year. Every year, we're getting sacks and sacks and sacks of plastic bottles, used this, used that, being filtered out by the mangroves, by this sort of tidal flood in and then drift out. And so they're actually helping us actually gather this stuff together, and then we can collect it and remove it. Ideally, you don't chuck it in the system at the beginning, right? That's the ideal thing. And actually, and interestingly, there's been an increase in the extent of mangroves in the Moreton Bay system. So the first really comprehensive survey was done in 1955, and then the more recently another one in 2012, and in the intervening period they saw an increase in the amount of mangroves. Now, how did that happen? Well, basically mangroves are marching inland. Mangroves are great at doing that thing of trapping naturally sediments. All right, so as the mangroves grow up, so they can profile forward into the sea, so they naturally reclaim land.
So it's like a marine version of desertification, almost. Like it's just creeping and increasing its own.
Yeah, but it's a rich environment. I mean, it's a rich community. True. Okay, so it's like, you know, being invaded by something very nice. So, like, you know, very happy aliens. Who, you know, so, but the trouble is, the challenge is that it's also been moving landward. All right, sea level rise is moving it landward. And where you've got the other important wetlands like salt marshes, which are an endangered habitat, all right? So they're, you know, really high risk because the salt marsh is trapped between whatever urbanization has gone on and the mangrove community. So as the mangrove community moves landward, that's going to pinch out those salt marsh areas. So one of the highest priorities is protecting salt marsh.
Right. And I guess, you know, if I know, having spent time in Brisbane myself, even just going mm-hmm. along the boardwalk, especially mm-hmm. at the bottom of the gardens at the bottom of the city itself, there's
sort
of a very
gardens,
thin
yeah.
strip
yeah.
of mangrove. And I think that yep. illustrates the example really well, is that it can't creep any further inland because that's it. It's all built up. There's a concrete wharf and that's it. Right. It's all built up. So you can kind of appreciate that we've kind of put a roadblock almost in terms of its
own. We have a bit. One interesting point in that discussion about where mangroves occur in the Brisbane River, which is the major river that runs through Brisbane City. It's the biggest one that empties into the bay, is that when Moreton Bay was first explored by the folks that were following Cook, that they couldn't discern the mouth of the Brisbane River. All right, it was basically a mangrove delta. And when John Oxley, who was one of the explorers that came out here, found or was shown the mouth of the Brisbane River and then pushed inland and went up the Brisbane River, he realized it was a great place to put a settlement. And soon after, they started to dredge that to make it more accessible for shipping. So what that did was actually change the salinity profile of the Brisbane River, so that whereas you'd had this, you know, sort of mangrove delta slowing the incursion of the tide, the salt water from the bay, it then allowed salt water more easily to penetrate the bay and then for fresh water to flush out. So what you got then was a shift in communities from what would have been, you know, fairly estuarine / freshwater communities where Brisbane sits now, to an area where it's much more favourable for things like mangroves. So we've actually extended the penetration of mangroves up the Brisbane River by removing the barrier at the end of it, deepening that channel and accelerating water flow. So there are these habitats that, you know, one might even consider secondary. The mangroves are there because of something that humans did. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? Well, as I said, the University of Queensland, which sits further up the river than the Brisbane City, has lots of mangroves, and these mangroves are doing a nice filtering job. So there's a little bit of swings and roundabouts. So you're totally right in terms of, you know, quenching off that habitat. There's nowhere for these places to retreat as sea level rises. And, of course, our focus should be on addressing climate change and try to arrest those processes rather than necessarily, as we're having to do at the moment, adapt to them. That's all these, you know, climate change adaptation is all about, you know, how do we accept defeat in the most effective way.
So you mentioned climate change, and we talk a lot about the devastating impacts of deforestation on climate change and the role of trees for carbon storage. But globally, wetlands are estimated to store over a third of the world's terrestrial carbon. So they are really important carbon sinks as well, aren't they?
Yep. Really, really good. We need to have them. And, you know, the protection of wetlands is very high on the list of objectives under that carbon capture. You know, they come up with all these ideas about various forms of sequestration, but nature can do it very, very well if you let it. So I think that's the trick, is we've got to be looking at these habitats in a different way and, valuing them for things like the fisheries, recreational amenity, but also looking at those aspects of their ability to naturally trap carbon. And I think that's something that folks are coming to realize, but it's not really widely known. So I think the more folks that do understand that, the stronger the voice will be when it comes to pushing back against things that might hurt wetlands. So yeah, absolutely.
So you've mentioned some of the projects that the Moreton Bay Foundation is supporting and doing, which is brilliant. But what can we as listeners, as individuals that feel attached to it, to somehow think, no, I appreciate the importance, I want to see those mangroves, or not mangroves, but wetland areas protected. What can we do other than stop polluting the waters and so on? But what can we actually do?
Well, the direct personal choice is about, you know, changing behavior to try and protect things. And that's very much for individuals to do. So hopefully listening to this, maybe folks will understand or have a greater understanding of the value of these wetland areas that otherwise might not have previously valued as much. Mm. Get involved locally. I think that was a big thing. I mean, we were looking at, when we were setting up the foundation, we were looking around saying, well, who is actually focused on Moreton Bay as an entity? You know, various folks look at different aspects of it, whether it's seagrass or coral or mangroves or wading birds and so on and so forth. But those often operate at a state level or even a national level. Whereas, you know, our ability to affect meaningful change really comes from understanding what's going on in a local area. So my message to folks is, whether you're living, you know, whether you're here in Australia, if you're in the Moreton Bay region, in Moreton Bay catchment, you know, find out what the Moreton Bay Foundation's doing. There are links there to what other organisations are doing in this area as well. So that'll help you get engaged. But wherever you are, you will at some point interact with wetlands, all right? I don't care if you're in the centre of the New Zealand or the US or whatever. There are freshwater wetland habitats with which you'll interact.
Yeah.
And those are really important as well. So I think the thing is, have your radar on for what the global signals are about what's going on and what values these things have, but very much get involved at a local scale. I had a lovely conversation with a person a couple of days ago about there's a part of Moreton Bay called Redcliffe, and it's got red cliffs, which is so that person's based up there, and they're very interested in sort of marine habitat restoration. And that person was working very locally, all right, working locally with folks in local government, working with local community groups, local industries to focus things there. And, you know, we celebrate that, you know. So if each of the regions around Moreton Bay is empowered with the information to understand where it fits in the whole, then we can affect change. So I think the message I would have to all your listeners is, have a good look around, you know, what wetland habitat is near you. Get involved in understanding a bit more about it. That would be a great service. So
I think schools is a great avenue too, because I recall I was super young, and this is back in South Africa, in Durban on the coast, and we did a day tour in our mangrove swamp area, and yeah, it was all fun because we were trotting through mud, but I still remember aspects of, you know, learning about specific, you know, trees that grow in seawater. How's that possible? And you know, very specific life, like certain crabs and other, you know, life that's specifically for those areas. Now, I also believe that in the Moreton Bay area, the catchment area, there's
dugong.
That's it. Where it's the only place in Australia where they basically concentrate, gather in herds. Is that
much larger amounts, I think.
Yeah, well, yeah. Let me just go to education first and school, role of schools, and then I'll talk about dugong a little bit, if that's okay. So, yeah, you're absolutely fundamentally right. I mean, I love teaching kids about stuff, all right? And, you know, kids, for me, kids range anything up to within 10 years of my age, right? So it's... But one of the great programs that's supported by the Education Department of Queensland, Education Queensland, is the Moreton Bay Environmental Education Centre. And it supports these education centres along the coast of Queensland. The one that I work a lot with is called the Moreton Bay Environmental Education Centre. It's a school. It has a principal. It has teachers. But it gets groups of students from various schools in the region that then go on excursions that look at, so, you know, sort of the history of the bay. They also look at the natural environment of the bay. One of the great things they have is this like 12-meter catamaran that can take up to 40 students, and it's called the Inspiration, and it's there to inspire the next generation of scientists. And they conduct scientific surveys. These are, you know, primary school and secondary school scientists. And they are engaged. I go on the boat. Some of my PhDs go on the boat with them as well. And we basically assist the teachers, teach the students about what science is, but very importantly about what the various values of the, you know, the water, the sediments, the reefs, the seagrasses, what have you, the plankton, stuff drifting around in the water. And it's so exciting to chat with those. It's lovely to break with them. We usually land on an island called St. Helena and have lunch there, and you can sit down and have these wonderful conversations with these, you know, students, and remarkable knowledge and remarkable ability, and it's just, they're just soaking it all up, right? I mean, literally. And then as soon as lunch is finished, they, you know, we wander off to the shore to have a walk around the edges of the bay. It's just, they're so excited. It's such absolute pleasure teaching them, you know, and also learning from them. Because they often ask questions that are unfiltered by their experience or whatever they've been shown, and they're asking questions. Oh, okay, hadn't really thought of that before. So, and then you try and stitch it together. So the education side of things is being well done here, I think, in terms of our habitats. But the impacts of that on the broader community won't roll out for another, 5 to 10 years. That program's been going since 2016, 17, I think. Anyway, so that's the education side of things. There's a great the knowledge of the teachers in schools is just terrific nowadays, I think, compared to the diversity of knowledge that teachers had when I was young. All right, so inspirational. Dugong. So, a very important dugong community in Moreton Bay, probably around about 600. For those of you who aren't familiar with dugong, you might have seen images of manatees. So they're in the same group, the Sirenidae, the same family. And the manatees are really around the Caribbean, northern South America, and of course, the Gulf Coast of the U.S. and the Atlantic Coast of the southern states of the U.S. So they have similar sort of habitats. The manatees are more sort of estuarine freshwater than our dugong. Our dugong are marine. If you want to spot the difference, and the manatee has a very rounded paddle-shaped tail, whereas a dugong has a tail shaped more like a dolphin. All right, so that's an easy way of distinguishing them. Our dugong feed on seagrass, which folks will probably know about. And the dugong in Moreton Bay, as I said, population around about 600 or so. And this is the most southerly extent of dugong. All right, dugong are distributed throughout the Indo-Pacific, some of the up through India and points west of there. So they've got quite a wide distribution. It's tropical generally. And because we've got the East Australian Current, the EAC, pushing down the coast, bringing warmer water, we've got that sort of slightly milder climate than we would have if we had another current system. So the dugong pushed down to the level of Brisbane, but no further south unless they're sick. So, really important population in effectively a suburban marine park. I mean, if you're familiar a little bit with Moreton Bay, you can walk to the end of the jetty in Wynnum, and this is on the land side coast of Moreton Bay, and see dugong. So, and you can go up in some of the passages towards Bribie Island or down towards the Gold Coast, and there are dugong there. It's just wonderful. These massive animals can survive in the face of all this use of the bay, all these boats and other things going on the bay. So, they're pretty resilient, but they need to be given space to do their thing.
Now, speaking of marine life, I believe another species found in the waters are sharks, and in particular tiger sharks. Now,
tiger as in stripes on the side, or
no, water. Water-based tiger sharks, maybe. But I came across a publication that you were one of the co-authors on, and it's quite fascinating. Something that I'm it's quite close to my heart in terms of sharks and protecting such an important species of the marine sort of world. Do you want to tell us just very briefly what that, I know we're digressing a little bit, but I think it's quite fascinating here, is just tell us a little bit about what that that was all about.
Well, it was actually my most excellent and wonderful colleague, Bonnie Holmes. She's a lecturer at Sunshine Coast USC University now, and that was her PhD. And Bonnie's an amazing woman. I like little fish like this, right? I study like things like blennies and gobies and things that will eat biofauna, which we discussed earlier. And but Bonnie was set on studying tiger sharks, and she would go out and catch these things to tag them, and she'd put tags on them, and the tags would relay data to a satellite, or they'd. When they detach, they send off a signal. You go and pick them up, and you download the high resolution data. But so what she was able to show was the quite significant movements of these animals, which we kind of regard as a tropical surface dwelling shark. You see images of them maybe chowing down on a turtle or something, a dead turtle carcass. But her data showed that they can make quite significant migrations or movements. I should say movement rather than migration. Movement is a going to another place. Migration is when you and others share a trip to another place.
Yeah.
And also in terms of their use of depth, we think of them as surface sharks, and these things can go down, you know, swim down to, you know, nearly a kilometer deep. So in search of things. So the more we look at data from these large animals using these sophisticated tags, satellite tags, pop-up tags, we're finding that, you know, our perceptions of them were driven by where we see them when we're doing things in our little thin sliver of the surface of the ocean we can access by snorkeling or scuba diving. And we're just seeing that little narrow window. We encounter them there. We go visit them when we know they're there. We don't understand the other elements to it about when they're able to use the depths. All right. So the twilight zone. All right. The twilight zone is that part of the ocean technically known as the mesophotic, where daylight is a very, very low concentrations, right? So there's like, you know, 1% of surface is light, something like that. It's very dim. It's this twilight zone. Lots of animals use that, right? Small things use that sort of shelter. So, you know, the visual systems of things that occupy the lit zone of the ocean start to become degraded when you're down at depth. And there's actually a whole bunch of animals that when night falls, they migrate vertically through the water column up into the surface waters. And then when sun rises, they start to move back down again to the depths. So there's actually a huge resource of things that are living there. They're moving up at night, getting nutrients from the surface, then moving back down again. So we're finding that a lot of animals are using those and making quite deep dives to go and access that resource. So, yeah, the pace of discovery in marine systems is greatly increasing with the new technologies that are available. And we're finding it more accessible. We're finding out that more animals are using things we didn't suspect previously. Yeah. Sorry, I'm wittering on a bit, but yeah.
That was my fault because I took you down that path. But I do.
Well, you took me down the path. The other thing I should point out is once you've written the paper or participated, you rarely go back and have a careful read through it, right? So you've had enough of it. So
no, but you were right because I'm looking here down to depths of 920 meters, but the distance is phenomenal. 1,800 kilometers all the way to New Caledonia from Sydney.
Yeah.
In 48 days. So
pretty big.
You like you say, very little we know. Yeah.
What was going through his mind when he goes, oh, I might have a little tropical journey, you know? I don't know. I'm thinking, you know? So who knows? I mean, the other thing is what motivates some of these big movements in animals. What do they know? You know, some of this stuff is just like mind-blowing, you know, about knowing where aggregations of food might be and then navigation. All right. Like I couldn't row a boat there with a GPS, you know, if I had a GPS. So, so all those things are kind of these exciting elements of the amazing things that marine organisms can do, and we're just finding out more and more, and then just it's fascinating to get engaged in. So anyway, thanks for the left fielder about tiger sharks.
Well, I mean, it's you know, I know things like shark nets and what are they, those drums?
Drumline,
which I never came across before until I was in Brisbane. But it's quite contentious.
South Africa has a program as well.
I didn't realize that. I only knew as shark nets and that was it. But there are a lot of species are deemed to be protected, even though.
Yeah.
You know, but in Australia, I don't know. Doesn't come across as that. So
it's. Yeah, it's a difficult thing.
Mm.
All right, so you know, if anybody started to put parachutes in planes, and everyone would have parachutes in planes, right? When you got in there like that, you know, they say there's a life vest or something. I want to know where the parachute is. So, but once you've got those things, you can't really take them away, right? So it's very difficult for politicians to go, well, yeah, we understand these might be, you know, a few other things might be getting killed along the way, but you know, the push against that is quite a challenge to come across. It takes some bravery to get things like that changed, removed. Once they're operating in the system, this is like kind of like, you know, faith that the things are working. If you look at these shark nets, I mean, they're not sealing off the beach. It's not as though the beach is isolated. You know, the sharks are being kept outside of the net. The purpose of the net is to kill sharks.
And actually catch them on the way out too, which is quite ironic. So
catch them on the way out, the way in. I mean, you know, and also there's some arguments to say, well, you know, if you've got things being caught in that net and dying, that's a magnet for sharks, all right? So, you know, yep. Sharks will come in and have a go at it. And then, you know, dolphins get trapped, migrating whales get trapped in the lines, and it's just, it's a challenging thing. As I say, in terms of, you know, the political will to change those sorts of things, that's quite a challenge once it's in, yeah, so.
And you're up against public perspective as well. I mean, I think Jaws probably has a lot to do with that, but people are irrationally fearful of sharks. Statistically,
yeah. I wouldn't get, you know, that's why I work on gobies and things like that. I'm not going to get savaged by a goby, all right? It's like, it's got my leg, you know, it's like, you know, so I'm a bit of a chicken when it comes to that, but I swim in waters where I know there are large animals that could potentially eat me, but they just do it so infrequently, it's not worth it. I mean, you know, you wouldn't go driving, you wouldn't drive out of your away from your home if you were worried about that level of risk. You should leave the car at home, right? So working in your kitchen at home, cooking a meal is more risky than, you know, swimming with a few sharks. So I don't know. I understand it's like, you know, I guess crocodiles, any of those large animals hold a certain innate fear for us about being consumed by them. We think about, you know, what would it feel like to have your leg chewed off, you know? So, whereas we ignore things that are more commonplace for us, that we're more accepting of.
Yeah.
And I think the more communication about that, you know, the low risk and ways of mitigating risk, all right, not swimming at dawn and dusk and not, you know, swimming near bait schools and these sorts of things. And I think you had someone munch in New Zealand a little while ago, not too long ago.
Just a couple of weeks ago. Yep.
Yeah, it wasn't. Yeah, I shouldn't use the term munch, but, you know, unfortunately lost their lives to a shark. So, you know, examine the circumstances around that and find out what you shouldn't be doing. It's like swimming near bait. It's not a good thing.
Yeah. And that happens a lot from passing fishing boats and so on. But that kind of circles back to the Moreton Bay area. You know, it's a marine park. You know, there's a foundation that does a lot of work to preserve the integrity of the area. But it's similarly, like we said right at the beginning, it's also an area that's used by a lot of recreational anglers. There's beaches, there's people swimming in the waters. There's, you know, if you go to Moreton Island itself, you're scuba diving, you're snorkeling. So it's that conflict, you know, where you want to respect what's in there, but at the same time, well, man wants to come and enjoy it themselves and have to make some changes to allow for that without, you know, minimizing risk. So I think...
Well, there are strategies in place. Okay, so one of the major things that was a problem were boat strikes on turtles and dugong, all right, where the propeller of a boat on the plane, all right, tilted up like that, going along, is going at a speed that... The speed of sound in water is so fast you can't use directional hearing, okay? So we rely upon the relatively slow speed of sound through the air to receive signals differentially in time between your right ear and your left ear, right ear and left ear. So that allows us to perceive the direction from which sound is coming within about five degrees, you know, between 5 and 15 degrees. So you can turn, you know, you clap and someone turns their head. When you're in water, sound is traveling so fast that for us or any other, the separation of the hearing organs is insufficient to be able to discriminate direction. So all you know is something is getting louder or it's getting less loud. You don't know where it's coming from. So marine organisms can't make choices in terms of trying to avoid these things. They can just become more panicky when the sound gets louder. So the impact between a propeller and a dugong can be fatal. The impact between a large vessel's propeller and whales, it can be fatal, and basically chops the animal up. Turtles are similarly afflicted. So they've actually set some areas in Moreton Bay in parts where there are shallow feeding grounds that are used by turtles and dugong, where you're not allowed to take your boat on the plane. You have to go with the hull submerged in the water. So that's been an important thing. And we've got a terrific marine park team here that manage the zoned Moreton Bay Marine Park. And that's a really big thing, I think, where you can use that zoning process to protect particular areas of habitat, regulate what folks can do in different areas, And then scientists come in and say, well, you know, are those management strategies having an effect? So we're very fortunate that we do have a marine park over most of Moreton Bay. There are some small areas excluded for practical purposes, but generally you're operating in a marine park, so there are rules in different parts of that park, as it would be if you entered a terrestrial park. You know, there's certain rules on where you can light fires, for example, or whether you can gather wood. So those same things folks are familiar with, I think, that are regular users of the bay.
Ian, we want to thank you so much for coming onto the show. It's been absolutely enlightening learning about a particular part of our planet that we don't know as much. And, you know, and I think you really illustrated the point of education, how important that is, not just appreciating a wetland of any form, whether it's marine, freshwater, and so on, but even getting a little bit involved and looking up, say, a foundation like the foundation you're a part of, the Moreton Bay Foundation, and learning about what it is that you do, why is that particular ecosystem so unique to that area and why it's important to that area. And hopefully, you know, more people will appreciate that as much as we appreciate the importance of rainforests and the importance of clean oceans. Wetlands are kind of that bridge in between, and they're super, super important. The most affected, and, you know, we really do stand to lose what's left of them around the planet. So thank you so much for sharing your knowledge, your insight, and it's been a real pleasure. Thank you very much.
No, Ben and Emma, thank you so much for the invite. I really enjoyed it, having a chat with you. I do love these topics. So anyway, you stay safe, and your audience also. So thanks a lot.
Thank you for listening to the Lentil Intervention Podcast. If you found this interesting, make sure you subscribe and share it with your friends.